The habits of early childhood cling to us all through life. Fortunate indeed is the child whose parents have the foresight and the understanding of the value as a character builder, of the habit of saving, to inculcate this habit into the minds of their children. It is a training that yields rich rewards. Give the average man $100 that he did not contemplate receiving, and what will he do with it? Why, he will begin to cogitate in his own mind on how he can spend the money. Dozens of things that he needs or thinks he needs will flash into his mind, but it is a rather safe bet that will never occur to him unless he has acquired the savings habit to make this $100 the beginning of a savings account. Before night comes, he will have the $100 spent, or at least he will have decided in his mind how he is going to spend it, thus adding more fuel to the already too bright flame of habit of spending. We are ruled by our habits. It requires force of character, determination, and power of firm decision to open a savings account, and then to add to it on a regular basis, if small, portion of all subsequent income. There is one rule by which any man may determine, well in advance, whether or not he will ever enjoy the financial freedom and independence which is so universally desired by all men, and this rule has absolutely nothing to do with the amount of one's income. The rule is that if a man follows the systematic habit of saving a definite proportion of all money he earns or receives in other ways, he is practically sure to place himself in a position of financial independence. If he saves nothing, he is absolutely sure never to be financially independent, no matter how much his income may be. The one and only exception to this rule is that a man who does not save might possibly inherit such a large sum of money that he could not spend it, or he might inherit it under a trust which would protect it for him. But these eventualities are rather remote, so much so in fact that you cannot rely upon such a miracle happening to you. This author enjoys a rather close acquaintance with many hundreds of people throughout the United States and in some foreign countries. For nearly 25 years, he has been watching many of these acquaintances and knows, therefore, from actual experience how they live, why some of them have failed, why others have succeeded, and the reasons for both failures and success. This list of acquaintances covers men who control hundreds of millions of dollars and actually own many millions which they have acquired. Also men who have had millions of dollars, all of which passed through their fingers, and they are now penniless. For the purpose of showing the student of this philosophy just how the law of habit becomes a sort of pivotal point on which success or failure turns, and exactly why no man can become financially independent without developing the habit of systematic savings, the living habits of some of these many acquaintances will be described. We will begin with a complete history, in his own words, of a man who has made $1 million in the field of advertising, but who now has nothing to show for his effort. This story first appeared in the American magazine, and it is here reprinted through the courtesy of the publishers of that publication. The story is true in every respect, and it has been included as a part of this lesson because the author of the story, Mr. W.C. Freeman, is willing to have his mistakes made public with the hope that others may avoid them. I have made $1 million, but I haven't got a cent. While it is embarrassing, yes, humiliating publicly to confess to an outstanding fault that has made a good deal of a mess of my life today, nevertheless, I have decided to make this confession for the good it may do. I am going to make a clean breast of how I let slip through my fingers all the money I have earned thus far in my lifetime, which approximates $1 million. This amount I made through my work in the field of advertising, except a few thousand dollars I earned up to 25 years of age by teaching in country schools and by writing newsletters to some country weeklies and daily newspapers. Maybe one lone million does not seem a lot of money in these days of many millions and even billions, but it is a big sum of money just the same. If there are any who think to the contrary, let them count a million. I tried to figure out the other night how long it would take to do so. I found I could count an average of 100 a minute. On this basis, it would take me 20 days of 8-hour days each, plus 6 hours and 40 minutes, on the 21st day to do the stunt. I doubt very much if you or I were given an assignment to count 1 million $1 bills upon the promise that all of them would be ours at the end of the time, that we could complete it. It would probably drive us mad, and a lot of use the money would be to us then, wouldn't it? Let me say at the outset of my story that I do not regret, not for 1 minute, that I spent 90% of the money I made. To wish any of this 90% back at this time would make me feel that I would have denied much happiness to my family and to many others. My only regret is that I spent all of my money, and besides, if I had today the 10% I could have saved easily, I would have had $100,000 safely invested and no debts. If I had this money, I would feel really and truly that I was rich, and I mean just this, for I have never had a desire to accumulate money for money's sake. Those school teaching and newspaper correspondence days of mine bought some cares and responsibilities, but they were met optimistically. I married at the age of 21, with the full approval of parents on both sides, who believed thoroughly in the doctrine preached by Henry Ward Beecher that early marriages are virtuous marriages. Just 1 month and 1 day after I was married, my father met a tragic death. He was suffocated by coal gas. Having been an educator all his life, and one of the best, he had not accumulated any money. When he passed out of our family circle, it was up to all of us to pull together and get along somehow, which we did. Apart from the void left in my home by my father's death, my father and I and my mother and the only sister lived together. We had a joyful life, despite the fact that it was a tight squeeze to make ends meet. My mother, who was exceptionally talented and resourceful, she had taught school with my father until I was born, decided to open our home to a married couple, old friends of the family. They came to live with us, and their board helped to pay expenses. My mother was known far and wide for the wonderful meals she served. Later on, two well-to-do women, friends of the family, were taken into our home, thus increasing our revenue. My sister helped very substantially by teaching a kindergarten class, which met in the big living room of our home. My wife contributed her share to the household by taking charge of the sewing and mending. Those were very happy days. Nobody in the household was extravagant or had any extravagant tendencies, except perhaps myself, for I always inclined to be free with money. I liked to make gifts to the family and to entertain friends. When the first baby came into our home, a boy, we all thought heaven had opened its doors to us. My wife's parents, who took the keenest and deepest interest in our affairs, and who were always ready to lend a helping hand, were equally happy over the coming of their first grandchild. My brother-in-law, much older than my wife and a bachelor, could not understand at first the joy we all felt, but even he began to strut around like a proud peacock after a while. What a difference a baby makes in a home. I am injecting these details into my story merely to emphasize how the early days of my life were lived. I had no opportunity to spend much money, and yet I had as much happiness in those days as I have ever had since. The strange thing about it all is that the experience of those days did not teach me the value of money. If anybody ever had a practical lesson to guide him in his future, I certainly had it. But let me tell you how this early experience affected me. The birth of my son inspired me to do something that would make more money than I was getting at teaching school and in writing for newspapers. I did not want my wife, mother, and sister to feel that they would have to continue indefinitely to do their part in sustaining the household. Why should a fellow, big and strong and healthy, as I have always been, and with a reasonable amount of ability, be content to remain a spoke in the wheel? Why shouldn't I be the whole wheel, as far as providing for the family was concerned? Following my desire to make more money, I took on the selling of books in addition to teaching and writing for some newspapers. This earned for me quite a little extra money. Finally, I gave up teaching and concentrated on selling books and writing for the newspapers. My book selling took me to Bridgeton, New Jersey. It was here that I got my first real start in big money. I had to be away from home a great deal to do this work, but the sacrifice was worthwhile. I earned enough money in a few weeks to send more money home than I had contributed to the household in any year from my school teaching and the newspaper correspondence. After combing the territory in the Bridgeton zone, I became interested in a newspaper in that city, the Morning Star. It seemed to me that the editor and publisher of this paper needed a helper. I called on him and told him so. He said, "Heavens, young man, how can I hire you? I am not earning enough money to pay my own living." "That's just it," said I. "I believe together we can make the Star a success. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll work for you for 1 week for $1 a day. At the end of the week, if I have made good, I'll expect you to pay me $3 a day for the second week. And then, if I continue to do well, I'll expect you to pay me $6 a day for the third week, and we'll continue from there until the paper makes enough money to pay me $50 a week." The owner agreed to my proposition. At the end of 2 months, I was being paid $50 a week, which in those days was considered a big salary. I began to feel that I was well on my way toward making money, but all I wanted was to make my family more comfortable. $50 a week was just 4 times as much as I had made teaching school. My job on the Star embraced editorial writing, not very brilliant, reporting, just ordinary, the writing and selling of advertisements, fairly successful, proofreading, bill collecting, and so forth. It kept me humping 6 days a week, but I could stand it, for I was strong and healthy, and besides, the work was very interesting. I also contributed correspondence to the New York Sun, Philadelphia Record, and the Trenton Times, which brought me in an average of $150 a month, for this was a good news territory. I learned a lesson on the Star which eventually shaped the course of my life. I found out that there is a great deal more money to be earned by selling advertising than in writing for them. Advertising brings grist to the mill. I put over one advertising stunt on the Star, a write-up on the South Jersey oyster industry, paid for by the oystermen, that brought in $3,000 cash, which the publisher divided with me 50-50. I had never seen so much money at one time in all my life. Think of it, $1,500, 25% more than I had made in 2 years of school teaching and odd tasks. Did I save this money or any part of it? I did not. What was the use? I could do so much with it to make my wife, boy, mother, and sister happy that I let it go far easier than I had made it. But would it not have been a fine thing if I had put this money away for a rainy day? My work in Bridgeton attracted the attention of Sam Hudson, New Jersey correspondent of the Philadelphia Record, who was a shining example of that type of newspaper man whose greatest pleasure in life is doing things for others. Sam told me that it was time for me to get located in a big city. He thought I had it in me to make good. He said he would get me a job in Philadelphia. He did, and I moved with my wife and baby to Germantown. I was given charge of the advertising department of the Germantown Gazette, a weekly newspaper. At the start, I did not make as much money as I had earned in Bridgeton, because I had a chance to give up my newspaper correspondence. The news for this section was covered by other correspondents, but very soon I was making 25% more money. The Gazette increased its size 3 times to accommodate its advertising, and each time I received a very substantial increase in salary. In addition to this, I was given a job to gather social news for the Sunday edition of the Philadelphia Press. Bradford Merrill, managing editor of that newspaper, now a very important New York newspaper executive, assigned me a big territory to cover. This kept me busy every night in the week except Saturdays. I was paid $5 a column, but I averaged 7 columns every Sunday, which made me $35 a week extra. It was more money for me to spend, and I spent it. I did not know anything about budgeting my expenses. I just let it go as it came. I did not have time, or thought I hadn't, to watch my step in spending. A year later, I was invited to join the advertising staff of the Philadelphia Press, a big opportunity for a young man, for I got wonderful training under the management of William McLean, now the owner of the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin. I still retained my job as gatherer of social news, so my income was just about the same as that I'd been working in Germantown. But before long, my work attracted the attention of James Elverson Sr., publisher of the old Saturday Night and Golden Days, who had just purchased the Philadelphia Inquirer. I was offered and accepted the advertising management of this newspaper. This meant a big increase in my income, and soon afterward there came a happy increase in my family, the birth of my daughter. Then I was able to do what I'd longed to do since the birth of my son. I got the family together again under one roof. My wife had two babies, my mother and sister. At last I was able to relieve my mother of any cares or responsibilities, and never again did she either of us as long as she lived. She died in her 81st year, 25 years after my father's death. I shall never forget her last words to me. "Will, you have never caused me a moment's worry since you were born, and I could not have had more than you have given me had I been the Queen of England. I was making at this time 4 times more money than my father had made as a superintendent of public schools in my hometown of Phillipsburg, New Jersey. All the money, however, passed out of my pockets as easily as water flows through a sieve. Expenses increased with every increase in my income, which is the habit, I suppose, with most people. There was no sane reason, though, for letting my expenses go beyond my income, which it did. I found myself piling up debts, and from this time on, I was never out of debt. I did not worry about my debts, though, for I thought I could pay them off at any time. It never occurred to me, not until fully 25 years later, that debt eventually would bring upon me not only great anxiety and unhappiness, but that I would lose friends and credit as well. But I must pat myself on the back for one thing. I was giving full rein to my big fault, spending money as fast as I made it, often faster, but I never shirked my work. I was always trying to find more things to do, and I always found them. I spent very little time with my family. I would go home to dinner every night and romp with the babies until their bedtime. Then I would return to the office and often work again. So the years went by. Another daughter arrived. Presently, I wanted my daughters to have a pony and a cart, and I wanted my son to have a riding horse. Then I thought I needed a team to take me around the family, driving them to a closed coop or an open trap. I got them all. Instead of one horse and a carry-all, or perhaps a team, which would have been sufficient for our needs and something we could have afforded, I had to have a stable, with all that goes with it. This outfit cost me nearly 1/4 of my annual income. Then I took up golf. This was in my 41st year. I went on my play the same as I went on my work, put my whole heart into it. I learned to play pretty well. My son and elder daughter played with me, and they learned to play well, too. It was necessary that my younger daughter should spend the winter in the South and summers in the Adirondacks. But instead of her mother going with her alone, I felt it would be fine if the son and other daughter went along with them. This arrangement was carried out. They went to Pinehurst, North Carolina, every winter, and to expensive resorts in the Adirondacks or in New Hampshire in the summer. All this took a great deal of money. My son and elder daughter were keen about golf and spent a lot of money on it. I also disbursed quite a little on golf courses around New York. Between the three of us, we won 80 prizes, most of which are now in storage. I sat down one day and calculated what these prizes had cost me. I discovered that each trophy had cost $250, or a total of $45,000 over the period of 15 years, an average of $3,000 a year. Ridiculous, wasn't it? I entertained lavishly at my home. Mount Clair folks thought I was a millionaire. I frequently invited groups of businessmen to have a day of golf at the club, and then to have dinner with me in the eve. They would have been satisfied with a plain home dinner, but no, I must serve them an elaborate affair staged by a famous caterer. These dinners never cost less than $10 a plate, which did not include the money spent for music while they were dining. I had a quartet come to the house, our dining room comfortably seated 20 people, and it was filled to capacity many times. It was all very lovely, and I was glad to be their host. In fact, I was very happy over it. I never stopped to think how rapidly I was piling up debts. The day came when they began to bother me a lot. I had entertained so many guests at the golf club one month, paying for luncheons, cigars, and green fees, that my bill was $450. This attracted the attention of the directors of the club, who were all good friends of mine and very much interested in my welfare. They made it their business to tell me that I was spending entirely too much money, and they wished for my sake that I could check my expenses. This gave me a bit of a jolt. It made me think seriously long enough to get rid of my horses and traps, at a big sacrifice, of course. I gave up our home and moved back to the city, but I did not leave any unpaid bills in Montclair. I borrowed the money to pay them. It was always easy for me to get all the money I wanted, despite my well-known financial shortcomings. Here are two sidelights of my experience during my flaring 40s. Besides spending money foolishly and perhaps recklessly, I loaned it with equal abandon. In cleaning out my desk at home before moving to the city, I looked over a package of due bills, the total of which was over $40,000. That was money handed out to just anybody who came along. I tore them all up, but I realized that if I had that money in hand, I wouldn't owe a dollar. One of the prosperous businessmen I had entertained many times, and who in turn had entertained me, said to me, "Billy, I've got to stop going on outings with you. You spend entirely too much money for me. I can't keep up with you." Think of that coming from a man who was making more money than I was. It should have struck home, but it didn't. I went on spending just the same, and I foolishly thinking that I was having a good time and with no thought of the future. This man is now one of the vice presidents of one of New York's greatest financial institutions, and is reported to be worth many millions of dollars. I should have taken his advice. In the fall of 1908, after my disastrous experience of 6 months in another line of business, following my resignation from the Hearst organization, I resumed newspaper work as advertising manager of the New York Evening Mail. I had known Henry Stoddard, editor and owner, back in the Philadelphia days, when he was a political correspondent for the press. Despite the fact that I was bothered by debts, I did my best work of my life on the Evening Mail, and made more money during the 5 years I was associated with it than I had ever made before. Moreover, Mr. Stoddard gave me the privilege of syndicating advertising talks, which ran in his papers for 1,000 consecutive publication days, and earned for me more than $55,000. Mr. Stoddard was very generous in many other ways, and frequently paid me special sums of money for doing what he considered unusual things in the way of developing business. During this period, I was so deeply in debt that in order to keep things moving as smoothly as possible, but without retrenching in the slightest way in my expenses, I borrowed money from Peter to pay Paul and from Paul to pay Peter. That item of $55,000 earned from syndicating advertising talks would have more than paid all my debts and left a nice nest egg besides, but all of it was spent as easily as though I hadn't a care in the world. In 1915, I went on my own in the advertising business. From that time until the spring of 1922, my fees ran into very big figures. I was still making more money than I ever did, and it was spending it just as fast as I made it, until finally my friends got tired of making me loans. If I had shown the slightest inclination to curb my expenses to the extent of only 10%, these wonderful men would have been willing to divide 50-50 with me, letting me pay them 55% of it and save 5%. They did not care so much about the return of the money they had loaned me as they wanted to see me pull myself together. The crash in my affairs came 5 years ago. Two friends who had stood by me loyally became impatient and told me frankly that I needed a drastic lesson. They gave it to me all right. I was forced into bankruptcy, which nearly broke my heart. I felt that every person I knew was pointing the finger of scorn at me. This was very foolish. While there was comment, it was not at all unfriendly. It was expressive of keen regret that a man who had attained so much prestige in his profession and had earned so much money should be allowing himself to get into financial difficulties. Proud and sensitive to the core, I felt the disgrace of bankruptcy so keenly that I decided to go to Florida, where I had once done a special piece of work for a client. It seemed to me to be the coming El Dorado. I figured that maybe I could make sufficient money in a few years so that I could return to New York, not only with the competency, but with enough to pay all my debts in full. For a time it looked as though I would realize this ambition, but I was caught in the big real estate collapse. So here I am back in the old town where I once had big earning power and hundreds of friends and well-wishers. It has been a strange experience. One thing is certain, I have learned my lesson at last. I feel sure that opportunities will come my way to redeem myself, and that my earning power will be restored once again to me. And when that time comes, I know that I shall be able to live as well as I did before, on 40% of my income. Then I shall divide the remaining 60% into two parts, setting aside 30% to pay my creditors and 30% for insurance and savings. If I allowed myself to feel depressed over my past or filled my mind with worries, I would not be capable of carrying on the fight to redeem myself. Besides, I would be ungrateful to my Maker for having endowed me with wonderful health all my life. Is there any other greater blessing? I would be ungrateful to the memory of my parents, whose splendid training has kept me anchored pretty safely in moral standards. Slipping from moral moorings is infinitely more serious in the end than slipping from the thrift standard. I would lack appreciation of the encouragement and support I have had in generous measures from hundreds of businessmen and to many good friends who helped me build a fine reputation in my profession. These memories are the sunshine of my life, and I shall use them to pave the way to my future achievements. With abundance of health, unfaltering faith, unflagging energy, unceasing optimism, and unbounded confidence that a man can win his fight, even though he commences late in life to realize the kind of fight he must make is therefore anything but death to stop him. Mr. Freeman's story is the same as that which might be told by thousands of other men who save nothing, with the exception that the amounts of their incomes would vary. The manner of living, the way the money was spent and why, was told in Mr. Freeman's narrative, show the way the spender's mind works. Compilation of statistics covering family incomes and expenditures of over 16,000 families of men who have been analyzed by the author disclose some facts that will help the person who wishes to budget his income and disbursements on a practical working basis that is sound and economical. The average income runs all the way from $100 to $300 per month. The budget allowance covering incomes within these two amounts should be about as follows. A family consisting of two persons whose income is $100 a month should manage to set aside at least $10 or $12 a month for the savings account. The cost of shelter or rent should not exceed $25 to $30. Food costs should average about $25 to $30. Clothing should be kept within an expenditure of $15 to $20 a month. Recreation and incidentals should be kept down to $8 to $10 a month. A family whose income is $100 a month, should that income be increased to $125, ought to save at least $20 of that amount. A family of two persons whose income is $150 a month should budget their funds about as follows. Savings $25, shelter around $35 to $40, food $35 to $40, clothes $20 to $30, recreation $10 to $15. Some might argue that a family of two making a wry of $300 a month might live just as cheaply as one making but $100 or $125. However, this is not quite correct, because one who has the ability to earn $300 a month must, as a rule, associate with people who make better appearance and more entertainment necessary. A single man earning $100 a month, $150 or $300, should save considerably more than a man with a family could on the same amount. As a rule, a single man who has no dependents and who is not in debt should live on a budget of $50 a month for room and board, and not to exceed $30 a month for clothes and perhaps $10 for recreation. A girl living away from home on the same income would require a slightly larger allowance for clothes, as women's general apparel is more costly than men's. It is a common practice today for families to purchase automobiles on monthly payments, which involve too great an expenditure compared to their income. A man with a Ford income has no business purchasing a Studebaker car. He should curb his desire and content himself with a Ford. Many single men spend their entire incomes and often go into debt because they maintain automobiles out of keeping up with such incomes. This common practice is fatal to success as far as financial independence may be considered a part of success in thousands of instances. The installment plan of buying has become so common, and it is so easy to purchase practically anything one desires, that the tendency to spend out of proportion to one's income is rapidly increasing. This tendency must be curbed by the person who has made up his mind to gain financial independence. It can be done by anyone who is willing to try. Another evil, which is both an evil and a blessing, is the fact that this country is so very prosperous that money comes easily, and if not watched, it goes still more easily. Since the beginning of the World War, there has been a steady demand for practically everything manufactured in the United States, and this condition of prosperity has caused people to lapse into a state of careless, unjustified spending. There is no virtue in keeping up with the pace set by the neighbors, when this means sacrifice of the habit of saving a regular portion of one's income. It is far better in the long run to be considered a bit behind the times than it is to go along with the youth into the days of maturity and finally into old age without having formed the habit of systematic savings. It is better to sacrifice during the age of youthfulness than it is to be compelled to do so during the age of maturity, as all who have not developed the habit of saving generally have to do. There is nothing quite so humiliating that carries such great agony and suffering as poverty in old age, when personal services are no longer marketable and one must turn to relatives or to charitable institutions for existence. A budget system should be maintained by every person, both the married and the single, but no budget system will work out if the person trying to keep it lacks the courage to cut expenses on such items as those of entertainment and recreation. If you feel so weak in willpower that you think it is necessary to keep up with the Joneses with whom you associate socially and whose income is greater than your own, or who spends all of their income foolishly, then no budget system can be of any service to you. Forming the savings habit means, to some extent at least, you must seclude yourself from all except a well-selected group of friends who enjoy you without elaborate entertaining on your part. To admit that you lack the courage to trim down your expenditures so that you can save money, even if only a small amount, is the equivalent of admitting at the same time a lack of a sort of character which leads to success. It has been proved many times too numerous to be mentioned that people who have formed the habit of saving money are always given preference in positions of responsibility. Therefore, the saving of money not only adds advantage in the nature of preferred employment and a larger bank account, but it also increases the actual earning capacity. Any businessman will prefer to employ a man who saves money regularly, not because of the mere fact that such person saves money, but because of the characteristics possessed by such a person which make him or her more efficient. Many firms will not employ a man or a woman who does not save money. It should be a common practice for all business houses to require all employees to save money. This would be a blessing to thousands of people who would not otherwise have the willpower to form the savings habit. Henry Ford has gone a long way, perhaps as far as is expedient, to induce his employees not only to save their money, but to spend what they do spend wisely, and to live sanely and economically. The man who induces his employees to form the habit of saving is a practical philanthropist. Opportunities that come to those who have saved money. A few years ago, a young man came to Philadelphia from the farming district of Pennsylvania and went to work in a printing plant. One of his fellow workmen owned some shares in a building and loan company and had formed the habit of saving $5 a week through the association. This young man was influenced by his associate to open an account with the building and loan company. At the end of 3 years, he had saved $900. The printing plant for which he worked got into financial difficulty and was about to fail. He came to the rescue with his $900, which he had saved in small amounts, and in return was given a half interest in the business. By inaugurating a system of close economy, he helped the business to pay off its indebtedness, and today he is drawing out of it, as is half of the profits, a little better than $25,000 a year. This opportunity never would have come, or if it had, he would not have been prepared to embrace it, had he not formed the habit of saving money. When the Ford automobile was perfected during the early days of its existence, Henry Ford needed capital to promote the manufacture and sale of his product. He turned to a few friends who had saved up a few $1,000, one of whom was Senator Cousins. These friends came to his rescue, put in a few $1,000s with him, and later drew out millions of dollars in profits. When Woolworth first started his 5- and 10-cent store plan, he had no capital, but he turned to a few friends who had saved, by the closest sort of economy and great sacrifice, a few $1,000s. These friends staked him, and later they were paid back hundreds of thousands of dollars in profit. Van Heusen, of soft collar fame, conceived the idea of producing a semi-soft collar for men. His idea was sound, but he had not a cent to promote it. He turned to a few friends who had only a few $100s, who gave him a start, and the collar made each of them wealthy. The men who started the El Producto cigar business had but little capital, and what they did have was money that they had saved from their small earnings as cigar makers. They had a good idea and knew how to make a good cigar, but the idea had died a bornin' had they not saved a little money. With their meager savings, they launched a cigar, and a few years later they sold out their business to the American Tobacco Company for $8 million. Back of practically every great fortune one may find, as its beginning, a well-developed habit of saving money. John D. Rockefeller was an ordinary bookkeeper. He conceived the idea of developing the oil business, which was then not even considered a business. He needed capital, and because he had developed the habit of saving, and had thereby proved that he could conserve the funds of other people, he had no difficulty in borrowing what money he needed. It may be truthfully stated that the real basis of the Rockefeller fortune is the habit of saving money, which Mr. Rockefeller developed while working as a bookkeeper at a salary of $40 a month. James Hill was a poor young man, working as a telegrapher at a salary of $30 a month. He conceived the idea of the Great Northern Railway system, but his idea was out of proportion to his ability to finance. However, he had formed the habit of saving money, and on the meager salary of $30 a month had saved enough to enable him to pay his expenses on a trip to Chicago, where he interested capitalists in financing his plan. The fact that he himself had saved money on a small salary was considered good evidence that he would be a safe man to trust with other people's money. Most businessmen will not trust another man with their money unless he has demonstrated his ability to take care of his own and use it wisely. The test, while it is often embarrassing to those who have not formed the habit of saving, is a very practical one. A young man who worked in a printing plant in the city of Chicago wanted to open a small print shop and go into business for himself. He went to a printing supply house manager and made known his wants, saying he desired credit for a printing press and some type and other small equipment. The first question asked by the manager was, "Have you saved any money of your own?" He had. Out of his salary of 30 a week, he had saved 15 a week regularly for nearly 4 years. He got the credit he wanted. Later on, he got more credit, until today he has built up one of the most successful printing plants in the city of Chicago. His name is George Williams, and he is well known, as is also the facts are started to the author of his course. Many years after this incident, the author of this course became acquainted with Mr. Williams, and at the end of the war in 1918, the author went to Mr. Williams and asked for credit accounting to many thousands of dollars for the purpose of publishing the Golden Rule magazine. The first question asked was, "Have you formed the habit of saving money?" Despite the fact that all the money I had saved was lost in the war, the mere fact that I had actually formed the savings habit was a real basis on which I got credit for upwards of $30,000. There are opportunities on every corner, but they exist only for those who have ready money or who can command money because they have formed the habit of saving and developed the other characteristics which go with the formation of savings habit, known by the general term of character. The late J.P. Morgan once said he would rather loan $1 million to a man of sound character who had formed the habit of saving money than he would $1,000 to a man without character who is a spendthrift. Generally speaking, this is the attitude which the world takes towards all men who save money. It often happens that a small savings account of no more than a few $100 is sufficient to start one on the highway to financial independence. A few years ago, a young inventor invented a household article which was unique and practical. He was handicapped, as inventors so often are, because he did not have the money to market his invention. Moreover, not having formed the savings habit, he found it impossible to borrow money through banking sources. His roommate was a young machinist who had saved $200. He came to the inventor's aid with a small sum of money and had enough of the articles manufactured to give them a start. They went out and sold from house to house the first supply, then came back and had another supply made up and so on, until they had accumulated, thanks to the thrift and savings ability of the roommate, a capital of $1,000. With this, plus some credit they secured, they bought the tools for manufacturing their own product. The young machinist sold his half interest in the business 6 years later for $250,000. He never would have handled this much money during his entire life had he not formed the habit of saving, which enabled him to come to the rescue of his inventor friend. This case might be multiplied 1,000 times with but slight variation to the details, as it is fairly descriptive of the beginnings of many great fortunes that have been made and are now in the making in the United States. It may seem like a sad, cruel fact, but it is a fact nonetheless, that if you have no money and have not developed the habit of saving, you are out of luck, as far as availing yourself of the opportunity to make money is concerned. It can do more harm to repeat, in fact, it should be repeated over and over again, that the real start of nearly all fortunes, whether great or small, is the formation of the habit of saving money. Get this basic principle firmly planted in your mind, and you will be well on your road toward financial independence. It is a sad sight to see a man, well along in years, who has sentenced himself to the wearisome treadmill of hard labor all the days of his life because he has neglected forming the habit of saving money. Yet there are millions of such men living in the United States alone today. The greatest thing in life is freedom. There can be no real freedom without a reasonable degree of financial independence. It is a terrible thing to be compelled to be at a certain place, at a certain task, perhaps a task which one does not like, for a certain number of hours every working day of the week, for a whole lifetime. In some ways, this is the same as being in prison, since one's choice of action is always limited. It is really no better than being in prison with the privilege of a trustee, and in some ways, it is even worse, because the man who is imprisoned has escaped the responsibility of providing a place to sleep, something to eat, and clothes to wear. The only hope of escape from this lifelong toil which curtails freedom is to form the habit of saving money, and then live up to that habit, no matter how much sacrifice it may require. There is no other way out of millions for people. And unless you are one of the rare exceptions, this lesson and all these statements of fact are meant for you and apply to you. Verse: neither a borrower nor a lender be, for loan oft losses both itself and friend, and borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry. This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou cannot say thee false to any man. Shakespeare. End of Lesson 4. The Law of Success, Lesson 5, Initiative and Leadership. You can do it if you believe you can. Before you proceed to the mastery of this lesson, your attention is directed to the fact that there is perfect coordination of thought running throughout this course. You will observe that the entire 16 lessons harmonize and blend with each other so that they constitute a perfect chain that has been built, link by link, out of the factors that enter into the development of power through organized effort. You will observe also that the same fundamental principles of applied psychology form the foundation of each of these 16 lessons, although different application is made of these principles in each of the lessons. This lesson on initiative and leadership follows the lesson on self-confidence for the reason that no one could become an efficient leader or take the initiative in any great undertaking without belief in himself. Initiative and leadership are associated terms in this lesson for the reason that leadership is essential for the attainment of success, and initiative is the very foundation upon which this necessary quality of leadership is built. Initiative is as essential to success as a hub is essential to a wagon wheel. And what is initiative? It is that exceedingly rare quality that prompts, nay, impels a person to do that which ought to be done without being told to do it. Albert Hubbard expressed himself on the subject of initiative in the words, "The world bestows its big prizes, both in money and honors, for one thing, and that is initiative." What is initiative? I'll tell you. It is doing the right thing without being told. But next to doing the right thing without being told is to do it when you are told once, that is to say, carry the message to Garcia. Those who can carry a message get high honors, but their pay is not always in proportion. Next, there are those who do the right thing when necessity kicks them from behind, and these get indifference instead of honors and pittance for pay. This kind spend most of the time polishing a bench with a hard luck story. Then, still lower down in the scale than this, we have the fellow who will not do the right thing, even when someone goes along to show him how and stays to see that he does it. He is always out of a job and receives the contempt he deserves unless he has a rich paw, in which case destiny patiently waits around the corner with a stuffed club. To which class do you belong? Inasmuch as you will be expected to take inventory of yourself and determine which of the 15 factors of this course you need most after you have completed the 16th lesson, it may be well if you begin to get ready for this analysis by answering the question that Albert Hubbard has asked. To which class do you belong? One of the peculiarities of leadership is the fact that it is never found in those who have not acquired the habit of taking the initiative. Leadership is something that you must invite yourself into. It will never thrust itself upon you. If you will carefully analyze all leaders whom you know, you will see that not only exercise initiative, but they went about their work with a definite purpose in mind. You will also see that they possessed that quality described in the third lesson of this course, self-confidence. These facts are mentioned in this lesson for the reason that it will profit you to observe that successful people make use of all the factors covered by the 16 lessons of the course, and for the more important reason that it will profit you to understand thoroughly the principle of organized effort which this reading course is intended to establish in your mind. This seems an appropriate place to state that this course is not intended as a shortcut to success, nor is it intended as a mechanical formula that you may use in noteworthy achievement without effort on your part. The real value of the course lies in the use that you will make of it, and not in the course itself. The chief purpose of the course is to help you develop in yourself the 15 qualities covered by the 16 lessons of the course, and one of the most important of these qualities is initiative, the subject of this lesson. We will now proceed to apply the principle upon which this lesson is founded by describing in detail just how it served successfully to complete a business transaction which most people would call difficult. In 1916, I needed $25,000 with which to create an educational institution, but I had neither this sum nor sufficient collateral with which to borrow it through the usual banking sources. Did I bemoan my fate or think of what I might accomplish if some rich relative or good Samaritan would come to my rescue by loaning me the necessary capital? I did nothing of the sort. I did just what you will be advised throughout this course to do. First of all, I made the securing of this capital my definite chief aim. Second, I laid out a complete plan through which to transform this aim into reality. Backed by sufficient self-confidence and spurred on by initiative, I proceeded to put my plan into action. But before the action stage of the plan had been reached, more than 6 weeks of constant, persistent study and effort and thought were embodied in it. If a plan is to be sound, it must be built of carefully chosen material. You will here observe the application of the principle of organized effort, through the operation of which it is possible for one to ally or associate several interests in such a way that each of these interests is greatly strengthened and each supports all the others, just as one link in a chain supports all the other links. I wanted this $25,000 in capital for the purpose of creating a school of advertising and salesmanship. Two things were necessary for the organization of such a school. One was the $25,000 capital, which I did not have, and the other was my proper course of instruction, which I did have. My problem was to ally myself with some group of men who needed that which I had, and who would supply me the $25,000. This alliance had to be made through a plan that would benefit all concerned. After my plan had been completed, and I was satisfied that it was equitable and sound, I laid it before the owner of a well-known and reputable business college, which just then was finding competition quite keen and was badly in need of a plan for meeting this competition. My plan was presented in about these words. Whereas you have one of the most reputable business colleges in the city, and whereas you need some plan with which to meet the stiff competition in your field, and whereas your good reputation has provided you with all the credit you need, and whereas I have a plan that will help you meet this competition successfully, be it resolved that we ally ourselves through a plan that will give you that which you need and at the same time supply me with something which I need. Then I proceeded to unfold my plan further in these words. I have written a very practical course on advertising and salesmanship. Having built this course out of my actual experience in training and directing salesmen, and my experience in planning and directing many successful advertising campaigns, I have back of it plenty of evidence of its soundness. If you will use your credit in helping market this course, I will place it in your business college as one of the regular departments of your curriculum and take entire charge of this newly created department. No other business college in the city will be able to meet your competition for the reason that no other college has such a course as this. The advertising that you do in marketing this course will serve also to stimulate the demand for your regular business course. You may charge the entire amount that you spend for this advertising to my department, and the advertising bill will be paid out of that department, leaving you the accumulative advantage that will accrue to you and your other departments without cost to you. Now I suppose you will want to know where I profit by this transaction, and I will tell you. I want you to enter into a contract with me in which it will be agreed that when the cash receipts from my department equal the amount that you have paid out of the contracted to pay out the advertising, my department and my course in advertising and salesmanship become my own, and I may have the privilege of separating this department from your school and running it under my own name. The plan was agreeable, and the contract was closed. Please keep in mind that my definite purpose was to secure the use of $25,000, for which I had no security to offer. In a little less than a year, the business college had paid out slightly more than $25,000 for advertising and marketing my course and the other expenses incidental to the operation of this newly organized department. While the department had collected and turned back to the college in tuition fees, a sum equaling the amount the college had spent, and I took the department over as a going and self-sustaining business according to the terms of my contract. As a matter of fact, this newly created department not only served to attract students for the other departments of the college, but at the same time, the tuition fees collected through this new department were sufficient to place it on self-sustaining basis before the end of the first year. Now you can see that while the college did not loan me one penny of actual capital, it nevertheless supplied me with credit which served exactly the same purpose. I said that my plan was founded upon equity, that it contemplated a benefit to all parties concerned. The benefit accruing to me was the use of the $25,000, which resulted in an establishment and self-sustaining business by the end of the first year. The benefit accruing to the college was that the students secured for its regular commercial and business course as a result of the money spent in advertising my department, and all advertising having been done under the name of the college. Today, that business college is one of the most successful schools of its kind, and it stands as a monument of sound evidence with which to demonstrate the value of allied effort. This incident has been related not alone because it shows the value of initiative and leadership, but for the reason that it leads up to the subject covered by the next lesson of this reading course on the law of success, which is imagination. There are generally many plans through the operation of which a desired object may be achieved, and it often happens to be true that the obvious and usual methods employed are not the best. The usual method of procedure in the case related would have been that of borrowing from a bank. You can see that this method was impractical in this case for the reason that no collateral was available. A great philosopher once said, "Initiative is the passkey that opens the door to opportunity." I do not recall who this philosopher was, but I know that he was great because of the soundness of his statement. We will now proceed to outline the exact procedure that you must follow if you are to become a person of initiative and leadership. First, you must master the habit of procrastination and eliminate it from your makeup. This habit of putting off until tomorrow that which you should have done last week or last year or a score of years ago is gnawing at the very vitals of your being, and you can accomplish nothing until you throw it off. The method through which you eliminate procrastination is based upon a well-known and scientifically tested principle of psychology, which has been referred to in the two preceding lessons of this course as autosuggestion. Copy the following formula and place it conspicuously in your room where you will see it as you retire at night and as you arise in the morning. Initiative and leadership. Having chosen a definite chief aim as my life work, I now understand it to be my duty to transform this purpose into reality. Therefore, I will form the habit of taking some definite action each day that will carry me one step nearer the attainment of my definite chief aim. I know that procrastination is a deadly enemy of all who would become leaders in any undertaking, and I will eliminate this habit from my makeup by A. doing some one definite thing each day that ought to be done without anyone telling me to do it. B. looking around until I find at least one thing that I can do each day that I've not been in the habit of doing and that will be of value to others without exception of pay. C. telling at least one other person each day of the value of practicing this habit of doing something that ought to be done without being told to do it. I can see that the muscles of the body become strong in proportion to the extent to which they are used. Therefore, I understand that the habit of initiative also becomes fixed in proportion to the extent that it is practiced. I realize that the place to begin developing the habit of initiative is in the small, commonplace things connected with my daily work. Therefore, I will go at my work each day as I were doing it solely for the purpose of developing this necessary habit of initiative. I understand that by practicing this habit of taking the initiative in connection with my daily work, I will not only develop habit, but I will also be attracting the attention of those who will place greater value on my services as a result of this practice. Sign the document. Regardless of what you are doing now, every day brings you face to face with a chance to render some service outside of the course of your regular duties that will be of value to others. In rendering this additional service of your own accord, you, of course, understand that you are not doing so with the object of receiving monetary pay. You are rendering this service because it provides you with ways and means of exercising, developing, and making stronger the aggressive spirit of initiative, which you must possess before you can ever become an outstanding figure in the affairs of your chosen field of life work. Those who work for money alone, and who receive for their pay nothing but money, are always underpaid, no matter how much they receive. Money is necessary, but the big prizes of life cannot be measured in dollars and cents. No amount of money could possibly be made to take the place of the happiness and joy and pride that belong to the person who digs a better ditch, or builds a better chicken coop, or sweeps a cleaner floor, or cooks a better meal. Every normal person loves to create something that is better than the average. The joy of creating a work of art is a joy that cannot be replaced by money or any other form of material possession. I have in my employ a young lady who opens, assorts, and answers much of my personal mail. She began in my employ more than 3 years ago. Then her duties were to take dictation when she was asked to do so. Her salary was about the same as that which others received for similar service. One day I dictated the following motto, which I asked her to typewrite for me. Remember that your only limitation is the one that you set up in your own mind. As she handed the typewritten page back to me, she said, "Your motto has given me an idea that is going to be of value to both you and me." I told her I was glad to have been of service to her. The incident made no particular impression on my mind, but from that day on I could see that it made a tremendous impression on her mind. She began to come back to the office after supper and perform service that she was neither paid for nor expected to perform. Without anyone telling her to do it, she began to bring to my desk letters that she had answered for me. She had studied my style, and these letters were attended to as well as I could have done it, in some instances much better. She kept up this habit until my personal secretary resigned. When I began to look for someone to take his place, what was more natural than to turn to this young woman to fill the place? Before I had time to give her the position, she took it on her initiative. My personal mail began to come to my desk with a new secretary name attached, and she was that secretary. On her own time, after hours, without additional pay, she had prepared herself for the best position on my staff. But that is not all. This young lady became so noticeably efficient that she began to attract the attention of others who offered her attractive positions. I have increased her salary many times, and she now receives a salary more than four times as large as the amount she received when she first went to work for me as an ordinary stenographer. And to tell you the truth, I am helpless in the matter, because she has made herself so valuable to me that I cannot get along without her. That is initiative transformed into practical, understandable terms. I would be remiss in my duties if I failed to direct your attention to an advantage other than a greatly increased salary that this young lady's initiative has brought her. It has developed in her a spirit of cheerfulness that brings her happiness, which most stenographers never know. Her work is not work it is a great interesting game at which she is playing. Even though she arrives at the office ahead of the regular stenographers and remains there long after they have watched the clock tick off 5 o'clock in quitting time, her hours are shorter by far than are those of the other workers. Hours of labor do not drag on the hands of those who are happy at their work. This brings us to the next step in our description of the exact procedure that you must follow in developing initiative and leadership. Second, you, of course, understand that the only way to get happiness is by giving it away to others. The same applies to the development of initiative. You can best develop this essential quality in yourself by making it your business to interest those around you in doing the same thing. It is a well-known fact that a man learns best that which he endeavors to teach others, If a man embraces a certain creed or religious faith, the first thing he does is to go out and try and sell it to others. And in exact proportion to the extent to which he impresses others, does he impress himself. In the field of salesmanship, it is a well-known fact that no salesman is successful in selling others until he has first made a good job of selling himself. Stated conversely, no salesman can do his best to sell others without sooner or later selling himself that which he's trying to sell.